Good morning. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm the Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and it's more than time that we had a public discussion of oil issues in Iraq. They've been of importance to us for a long time, and I'm just delighted that we have two very knowledgeable people, insiders, so to speak, who have consented to try to enlighten us. Jonathan Morrow, many of you know from his time spent in the Institute, mainly working on constitutional issues in Iraq. Tariq Shafiq is new to USIP, but it's a real pleasure for us to have been able to capture him during a family visit to the United States get him to talk a little bit about the oil issues in Iraq. I'm told just this morning, I didn't realize it, that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee will have the pleasure of hearing from them next week, along with Jim Plack, who's in the audience. So I think it wasn't my intention to preempt Mr. Biden and Lugar, but maybe we'll give a little dress rehearsal for the event. I'm going to remind all of you to turn off your cell phones, and let me ask Mr. Tariq Shafiq to take the floor first.
Is that switched on?
It should be switched on, yeah. If you talk right in.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, indeed, it's my pleasure to address you today. I'll try to make a few general remarks, then I go into some particulars of the Iraq oil industry, and then give you a brief on the draft of the petroleum legislation for Iraq. Let me start by saying that Iraq oil potential in our estimate is on par with Saudi Arabia, generally reported to be third worldwide. At our consultancy firm, we have made an estimate in 1997 that Iraq's potential reserves are of the order of 215 billion barrels. The proven reserves are of the order of 115 billion barrels. However, Iraq production and export has always lagged behind its real potential. It's indeed strange for a country that have that potential and producing today around 2 million barrels per day and export of the order of 1.5 million. There are many reasons for that. But before going to this reason, to give you the sadness with which we oil men from Iraq talk, is that I recall in 1961 when a particular act was passed by then the Prime Minister Abdel Karim Qasim, Law 80, Iraq was producing almost 1 million barrels per day. Saudi Arabia was producing around 1.25 billion barrels per day. So Saudi Arabia achieved years back about 10 million barrels per day. And today they are at that range as well, and Iraq is 2 million barrels per day. Many reasons for that. To start with, during the concession era, which ended in the early 70s, the IPC, the Iraq Petroleum Company, and its associates did not have all their eggs in Iraq. They had investment all over the Middle East, and they had to convince and satisfy the other oil-producing countries. And so there was quotas basically to each and everyone. And Iraq for a good many years was not the most settled country that invited confidence, and as such it remained behind. Past that, we went through the era of Saddam Hussein and its confrontational policy and the unnecessary wars Iraq had to undergo, and that kept Iraq behind. Then we turned into 2003, when there has been the change in government, at the new era, the production had to dip down from 2.8 million barrels per day to about 1 million barrels per day, but quickly recovered to about 2 million barrels per day, and today that's what we're producing. Iraq never had a legislation per se, a petroleum act, a comprehensive petroleum act that governed its operations and management. It's only this summer when serious steps had been taken to prepare a draft petroleum law. And I'm glad for that. I'm party to a group who were asked to prepare this draft, although in many journals we hear that it was the United States or the British who drafted that. I can assure you it wasn't anyone except the three Iraqis, associates of mine, who did that job. I'll try now to give you some particulars which are unique particulars of the Iraq oil industry, other than its failure to optimize to increase its production. Iraq finding cost to find a barrel of oil cost less than half a cent per barrel. Generally, anywhere else, the figures are of the order of $4 to $10 per barrel. The capital development cost per barrel is of the order of $0.50 to $1. Generally, we talk about up to $10 per barrel elsewhere. The operating cost is of the order of $1 to $1.50 per barrel. I have worked out a few guidelines for what the economic returns for investment in Iraq and to develop a daily barrel, one barrel per day, it will cost something of the order of $6,000. That is to say, to develop 1 million barrels per day, the order of magnitude would be $6 billion. There are a lot of figures, and my figures are while estimate, but they are consistent with our experience in Iraq. However, this figure might have gone up over the last year or two due to real inflation for equipment and the huge demand that has taken place in the oil industry. That figure may need to be increased by about 20% for that reason. And during this period of turbulence in Iraq, the security aspects would perhaps consume no less than an additional 30%. Now, the economics of what's generally called a PSA, a production sharing agreement, is such as the return on investment for $18 a barrel would be satisfied with an internal rate of return of 20% when the profit oil, the amount of profit oil that goes to the investor, is about 10%. This goes up to 40% internal rate of return when we talk about crude oil price of about $35, and it goes to over 60 and to 100 for a crude oil price of 70. Now, just for the purpose of explaining a little more on this, on the famous production sharing agreement, you have the investors who take care generally of the whole investment. Then what comes up after development is split in certain parts. One part is to cover the cost for the investor. And that is usually allocated anywhere between 10 to 40% of the total accrued produced. And then what's left is a profit oil. It is that profit oil I'm talking about. If the investor takes 10%, then the return is of the order I've talked about. I've just lost my charts. Okay? What has been happening due to the unique circumstances of Kurdistan government, they have accepted certain PSAs with companies under unique circumstances, and it has been reported that the profit share is of the order of 55%. This is most unusual, but it's due to that sort of circumstances. And calculated return of the investment when it is of that order can be over 100%. I would relate this to what has been reported recently that Iraq law permits PSA that would permit the British and American companies to reap 75% return on the investment. Well, this is a lot of confusion, and the law does not even state any figures. At least we say that PSA is not the only type. In fact, it will not be a PSA. It will be a modified PSA. Having said that, I'll try to state some facts about what were the principles governing the thoughts of those who drafted the petroleum law. As you know, the Constitution, and in particular the articles that relate or govern the oil management and investment, are somehow subject to more than one interpretation because of the type of fogginess with which they have been written. And for that reason, we, the group who drafted the Constitution, could not rely, although at the schedule, on the fact that there's going to be a constitutional review and these articles would be modified to be clear and to perhaps clarify with certainty the authority of the federal government versus the region. We drafted the law as if it is not going to be, as if the Constitution will not be changed. And particularly in view of the fact that the Kurdistan government had issued, and that happened, in fact, after we started drafting the petroleum law, they issued legal interpretations and a draft of their own that gave completely different interpretation from the one we had. The draft, however, tried to maneuver through these possible interpretation and settled on the vital interpretation for the first article, which state that oil and gas is the property of the whole nation. And for emphasis, it adds to say that in all the regions and governorates. That was the very principal one. And then the next article elaborate how the management will be in the hand of the central government in consultation with the regions and the others. I'm sure my colleague, who is the expert, will go through this. However, whatever differences in interpretations have by now been dropped out, and a responsible government man in London a few weeks ago has assured us that the thinking now is that their interpretation is compatible with the central government's. And what I understand now is that all the differences have been settled, in fact, and the draft is at hand. There might be one sticking point, which is a minor point yet, but I was told that has been resolved, though my friend here tells me it has not yet. Again, I lose my charts. The other principle which we adopted is that there ought to be a separation between the regulatory supervisory role of the ministry and the technical commercial operation that should go to a national oil company. We have also wanted to ensure that tendering procedure will be the rule and not negotiated approach. And for that tendering procedure, there are going to be model contracts to details the rules, the terms and regulations in it. Now, what some of the journals have already quoted, a lot of figures for what the PSA is and quantified it and all of this, there is nothing whatsoever in the draft law or in the subsequent negotiation of that these figures. And in fact, I must say I'm more surprised for a prestigious journal like the Independent on Sunday, who claimed to have had a copy of the draft to talk about quantitative figures and how the return on investment will be of the order of 70 or 75%. I don't know how much time I've got yet.
Well, take a couple of minutes.
Okay. Right. Now, I could list now for the audience the principles that govern the license, that govern the licensing code. One is competitive, as I said, licensing grounds. The others that the terms and condition will be stated in model contracts. The next is that there is going to be created a federal commission which act on behalf of the Council of Ministers, who would be delegated the authority from the Parliament to negotiate and agree and finalize contracts. The terms and the conditions have to honor particular objectives. Among these is the national control, ownership of the reserves, which remain in the states, under the state's ownership until past the terminal into the ship, and the that there must be only an appropriate return on the investment to the there must be an appropriate return on investment to the investor, and there must be reasonable incentive to the investor for ensuring solutions which are optimal to the country in long term, related to technology transfer, improved and enhanced technology, training, optimal utilization of the infrastructures, environmentally friendly solutions and the like, and what is called a local content that emphasizes the need to use local equipment, train Iraqi personnel, and encourage Iraqi investors to go in partnership with the foreign investors. The model contracts would be limited to three. One, a service contract. The other is a buyback contract. And the third is a modified PSA. Sometimes in the Ministry of Oil call it a petroleum development contract. That is really a type of mixture between the PSA and the buyback model contracts. The procedure, as I said, will be one of bidding, where only pre-qualified companies would be allowed to enter. The selection and ranking of successful applicants shall be on the basis of quality and relevance of proposed work plan and the anticipated economic rent to the nation. The overall allocation of exploration and production rights throughout the Republic of Iraq shall aim at achieving variety among oil companies. Even in the law, we were keen to ensure there is not going to be just American companies, just UK companies. Whoever is qualified is welcome in Iraq. Again, I'm sorry, I lost the templates. And hence, we wanted to assure a variety among oil companies and operators with different background, expertise, experience, and approach, so as to enhance efficiency through positive completion, benchmarking of performance, and transparency. The result of any successful negotiation and the endorsement of the contract shall be made available to the public within 2 months. The national oil company that shall be created, it will be a holding company and with operating companies for the different regions. And the different regions will have participation in these operating companies in their regions. And the supervisory entities of these regions would be initiated and started by the Ministry of Oil, handed over completely to the regions themselves to ensure that the coordination between the federal rule and the regions are there. The National Oil Company will have the ability to enter into joint venture, enter into service contract and the like in managing their own fields. And all the discovered field will be earmarked to the National Oil Company. However, these will fall in two categories. One are the present operating oil fields who will be immediately under their complete control. The discovered field, which are not yet developed, they would have to negotiate with the Ministry of Oil or the Cabinet on what terms under which they'll have it, and generally they will be encouraged to have associates or partnerships with the international oil companies. I think with having taken so much time, I will leave it now for my colleague to present his piece, and then we will answer questions and answers.
Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thanks, Dan. it's a great pleasure to be back here at USIP, speaking about matters that are obviously closely related to the work I did at USIP on the Iraq Constitution. I'm here now, of course, not as a staff member of USIP, but as a legal advisor to the Kurdistan Regional Government in Iraq. I don't represent them in this meeting. I will speak on my own behalf, I think, in the spirit of the frank discussion and debate that USIP encourages. I see Dan has titled this session Between Fiction and Reality, the Iraq Petroleum Draft. I'm not quite sure what discussion he was trying to provoke by that title. I'll resist the temptation to assert that one or other of the two governments in Iraq, the Kurdistan government or the central government, are real or fictional. And instead, after having heard Dr. Shafiq's very useful explanation of some of the provisions of the draft oil and gas law for Iraq, instead fix on one aspect of that draft, and in fact one aspect of Dan's title, the word between, and argue that progress on oil, significant progress that of course has been made, and other related matters, including revenue sharing in Iraq, will be solved by betweenness, by jointness, by cooperation, and I think this draft law shows that. It is not only in itself then a significant achievement in its own right, but I think shows the way forward for other types of progress in Iraq, again on revenue sharing and perhaps on somewhat unrelated matters like the legal system, the judiciary, perhaps even Kirkuk, the military and so on. That is to say that the draft oil law is not just a regular piece of Iraqi legislation that's sort of being signed off on by a number of Iraqi parliamentarians, as you'd expect in any regular government, any regular state, but instead it like so much else in Iraq, resembles a treaty document between the two significant entities in Iraq, the central government and the Kurdistan regional government. I won't hide my view that I think that politics in Iraq are already highly regional and local, and the constitution of Iraq, which envisages a fairly weak, if viable, federal government, is an accurate and useful map for this new landscape, and I think the draft oil law fits into this landscape. It describes it, will operate in it in a useful way, and in a way that will command real adherence by the negotiating partners. The first draft of this law, Dr. Shafiq mentioned that this was not a US concoction, and I think this is also should be emphasized, that unlike almost any other agreement I can think of that's emerged out of the corridors of power in Baghdad, this is one in which the US government, so far as I can tell, and having spent a lot of time in Baghdad and Erbil, I believe this to be true, the US government has had remarkably little involvement, that after the first draft was prepared by Dr. Shafiq and his associates, it was then worked on by a drafting committee of two principal actors, Dr. Rashdi Harami, the Kurdistan region Minister of Natural Resources, and Dr. Thama Gadban, the advisor to Prime Minister Maliki. At the centre of this law, and I'd like to just draw this out, is not a purely federal oil ministry that runs the Iraq petroleum sector in the way that it might have in years gone by, but rather an intergovernmental institution, a federal council for oil and gas, on which the Kurdistan regional government, and in fact any other region, will have representation. And as I've suggested, I think it's this intergovernmentality, this reciprocity betweenness, that will also, I expect, be the solution for petroleum revenue sharing amongst the regions and governments, the peoples of Iraq, as required by the Iraq constitution and possibly other matters as well. So if the petroleum law is, the draft petroleum law is a treaty, then I suppose the question today at the US Institute of Peace is whether it's a peace treaty. I'm a little sceptical about that, but I'll perhaps discuss that a little later. One of the questions was what remains to be agreed on the petroleum law. A great deal has been agreed. We've seen reports and heard reports that there is a draft that has been signed off on. I have to say it is my information from the Kurdistan Regional Government spokesman and oil minister is that the Kurdistan, and this is in view of light of reports that suggest the Kurdistan government has submitted to federal review approval of Kurdistan contracts, that the Kurdistan regional government doesn't support any such draft. So I guess the situation is simple. If the agreed draft asserts, if the draft in Baghdad asserts federal approval over Kurdistan contracts, then it's not agreed and significantly not agreed as between the federal government and the Kurdistan government, and therefore I suspect won't go very far. But if, I very much hope, the draft in Baghdad now is substantially similar to the draft that was on which principals shook hands in December, on December 17th last year, then there is an agreement. Just a little more on this, the question of approvals. I don't want to dwell on this, but this was, you know, you might as well know, the principal politically contentious issue in the negotiations, being resolved at a very high level. The Iraq constitution explicitly gives the Kurdistan regional government the power to sign new contracts in the Kurdistan region. This is by virtue of the operation of two articles, one that excludes petroleum, of course, and petroleum management from the exclusive powers of the federal government, another provision that says where a power is not part of the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government, then it's a regional power. I mean, it also explicitly confirms past Kurdistan regional government contracts. It's very, very difficult, I think, to see the Kurdistan region in this law or in any other law or instrument, for that matter, yielding on those constitutional gains. They were very firm on those positions in the constitutional negotiations, and now that those positions are crystallised in the Iraq constitution, I think it's very unlikely they will step back from those. So I think it would be very wise for the federal oil law to fall in line both with the constitution and, of course, the fact of Kurdistan's considerable progress on oil and gas. I look forward to confirmation that that is the case. The compromise position, again, just by way of explanation, was instead of for the Baghdad government to approve Kurdistan contracts, for the federal government to have the right to send Kurdistan contracts, to view Kurdistan contracts, and if there was any objection on commercial grounds or grounds of public probity, anything of that sort, to send those contracts to independent arbitration, to go to a panel of arbitrators to be agreed jointly by the federal government and the Kurdistan regional government. A very sensible offer, one that I think the Kurdistan regional government was not required to make under the constitution or any other instrument, but nonetheless one that was conducive to good cooperation and coordination nationwide on the development of petroleum, ensuring that production sharing agreements, since all licenses in the Kurdistan region are in the form of production sharing agreements, that they are consistent with principles of commerciality, that they don't allow investors to make out like bandits, to assuage any fears that the petroleum regime would be too generous. So that was the compromise proposal, and again, that's in the draft of December 17, and I very much hope that hasn't been meddled with, because I think it's a very useful instrument, and I think any other outcome will not likely hold for very long. What else remains to be agreed? Well, revenue sharing, of course, is something which we all think about as being hand in hand with the upstream development management of petroleum. The revenue, as Dr. Shafiq knows, the hydrocarbons law, the draft hydrocarbons law, foreshadows certain revenue sharing principles. But a revenue sharing law, a separate law, will need to be agreed, worked on, drafted, agreed. I think on revenue sharing, we're on very encouraging terrain, assuming that that agreement can be reached on the oil and gas law, on the hydrocarbons law, then agreement on revenue sharing should be in the offing. In particular, I'd highlight that the Kurdistan government has agreed to share nationwide all petroleum revenues that are generated from the Kurdistan region, not just revenues from existing fields. You may be aware of this distinction. I think Dr. Shafiq alluded to it in the constitution, between existing or current fields and fields which are not current, future fields. The KRG in the past has insisted on the right to retain revenues from future fields in the context of these negotiations. In the hydrocarbons law negotiation, they've agreed to pool all those revenues, of course, provided that there are transparent, credible, fair revenue sharing mechanisms in Baghdad. And again, I think the draft petroleum law touches on this in one particular article and envisages an intergovernmental institution to manage that. I think that's very sensible will provide one of the necessary platforms for stability and even, dare I say it, peace in Iraq. I think a year or two ago it was possible to be optimistic about these matters and to speculate that if revenue sharing from petroleum could be solved, and solved in the way in which the Constitution envisages it, then good things might happen. I suppose the theory was that those as I think the White House refers to those people in Iraq who do not have ready access to petroleum reserves, namely principally Sunni Arab Iraqis. The speculation has been that if they were able to be guaranteed their proportionate share of petroleum revenues and given those revenues, that a different type of politics might emerge in those regions, that it would greatly reduce levels of anxiety about exclusion from power and resources in Iraq, and I think that in fact the Baker Committee referred to this problem. I'm not so sure that a revenue sharing formula will, though necessary though it is, will produce those results. In particular, I observe that, so far as I know, and others may have other information, but having worked fairly closely, including with Dan, with some of the leaders in those communities, I don't see any signs that a proportionate share of Iraqi petroleum in the Sunni Arab governorates will reduce violence in those regions. It's very hard, in fact, impossible to find leaders who are prepared to even imagine Iraq as a regionalised entity with shares of revenues going directly to regions and governorates. I also observe that political representatives of those communities have not been closely involved in the Iraq petroleum negotiations and seem to be happy to let the government of Prime Minister Maliki stand in for them. I think this is and has been a strategic mistake on their part, since I can see every reason why government services, including even the provision of security in those parts of Iraq, should be delivered by regional or governorate entities. In any event, I'd very much downplay the impact of an oil law on the security situation. It's a necessary but not sufficient precondition. And, you know, hard though it is to believe, there are no belligerents in Iraq, whether Sunni or Shia or otherwise, that are stating their demands in terms of petroleum revenues. On economics, the economic effect, one of the questions, you know, we should know well enough by now that nice laws passed on pieces of paper in the green zone in Baghdad don't necessarily translate into reality. Attracting petroleum companies to Iraq, at least outside the Kurdistan region, will at least be as dependent on security as on legal clarity. However, this draft, when it passes, will lay down a coherent and workable legal framework. You know, as Dr. Shafiq has said, this is a real deal, a real Iraqi agreement. You know, not a US sort of pre-cooked outcome that may not last long. The US government has remained, I believe, peripheral to the not only the substance of the law, but to the process. We have, of course, seen some degree of pressure exerted by the US government to accelerate the petroleum law negotiations over the last few months, but I don't mind saying that the trigger, the catalyst for the negotiations that started last summer was the production by the Kurdistan regional government of its own petroleum law, which triggered, I think, a healthy flurry of activity, healthy competition in Baghdad, and really began the negotiations. And negotiations that, as I've mentioned, conducted by Dr. Harami and Dr. Gudbun, that were conducted by two very able, competent, experienced Iraqi negotiators who have had clear mandates from the elected representatives of their respective governments in Erbil and Baghdad. You know, talking about fiction and reality, but I also observe, again in the context of peace, that the negotiations seem to have been a real engagement on a real concrete subject matter, oil and money, where so many other efforts and so-called reconciliation initiatives in Iraq involving intersectarian dialogue and so on have fallen flat. Their subject matter was vague, if not fictional, and without any obvious tradable commodities, tradable items, approval powers, review, arbitration, revenue sharing, and so on. These are real things on which people can meet and talk and build relationships. I was in Baghdad last month, and a friend at the UN pointed out that in 2006 there were no fewer than 17 high-level proposals for peace initiatives in Iraq that have obviously failed. The oil negotiations, though they have merely economic goals, are showing more signs of success, I believe. On the economics, Dr. Shafiq has referred to the fact that the draft contemplates what it calls risked contracts, some bona fide PSAs, and this is, I think, an encouraging sign. Again, I was a little dismayed by the reportage in the Independent last week and the week before, I think it was, very much exaggerating the dividends that would be going to international oil companies. But I very much hope that this law, when it's agreed, will start a healthy competition amongst international oil companies for Iraq contracts, so that new revenue can be generated in parts of Iraq outside Kurdistan. As for the economic impact on Kurdistan itself, I wouldn't expect the passage of the law to have a dramatic overnight effect. The Kurdistan Regional Government Oil Ministry already has a range of mostly European and North American petroleum companies either having signed or in negotiations for exploration acreage, including medium-sized companies, and they're obviously attracting greater and greater interest from the oil majors. The Kurdistan government will maintain its own petroleum regime in Iraq, in its region of Iraq. It will amend the draft law that Dr. Shafiq referred to make it consistent with the Iraq law once it's agreed, but it will, of course, retain its constitutional right to manage its own affairs. There will be a Ministry of Oil in Kurdistan, and Kurdistan contracts, of course, will be negotiated by that government. However, the passage of the law would be a very good thing, of course, for the Kurdistan regional government. It would put an end to this, I think, rather counterproductive war of words that's flared up from time to time in the context of KRG and Baghdad positions. The passage of the law would, of course, give the Kurdistan regional government some assurance that Kurdistan region petroleum could be exported without objection from Baghdad, and would, I think, generally accelerate the pace of oil development in that part of Iraq, and of course, others. Perhaps I'll leave it there. Well, look, the question of constitutional amendment came up, so perhaps I can just return to my hobby horse, something that I've thought about and written about quite a lot. As we see these intergovernmental institutions emerge in these drafts, a draft petroleum law, draft revenue sharing law, it raises the question in my mind as a lawyer, why is it that in Iraq there is not, we don't resort to the conventional mechanism for representing the interests of regions and subnational entities, let's say, at the federal level. That is, of course, an upper house of parliament in federal countries, the US, of course, Australia, my own country. This is the way it's done. I see, just emerging from these discussions, it's clearer and clearer to me that there should be and could be a multi-party consensus on the creation of an upper house of parliament in Iraq that could be the location for these resolution of some of these issues, difficult issues, as between the Kurdistan government and Baghdad, that will continue to emerge, I would imagine, but a way in which for them to be dealt with in an orderly way. There is no institution, surprisingly enough, in Iraq for these matters to be ventilated on a government to government. I, at some level, I agree that the oil provisions themselves of the constitution could be improved. They are not as clear, perhaps, as they might be. I must say, I'm a little sceptical that you'll on that issue you'll be able to one will be able to find multi-party consensus on constitutional amendment. I mean, you need multi-party consensus, of course, because all parties significant groupings in Iraq have the ability to block any proposed amendment. There is the three-governorate veto power, the same as there was for the passage of the constitution itself. So you really do need unanimity on, or close to it, on constitutional amendment. Though it is the case, and I find it very encouraging, that the Kurdistan government, for its part, has been prepared to step down from its the letter of the law, from the its strict constitutional position. I doubt it that in the Iraq that we see now, the Kurdistan government would be prepared to make permanent constitutional concessions on those matters, and I'm referring to concessions on revenue sharing and perhaps this arbitration mechanism for the review of Kurdistan oil contracts. But the more one studies the petroleum industry in Iraq, the more I see also that a constitutional amendment to clarify the role of governorates in that constitution would be useful. Governorates are, I think, rather anomalously given the same powers as regions in the constitution, including powers over petroleum. I think that was unintended and is unnecessarily confusing. I think that there is possibility of multi-party consensus on that issue. And it may even be that revenue sharing principles could be described in greater detail with greater clarity, perhaps reflecting some of the basic outcomes, basic principles of the revenue sharing law, which I expect will emerge from the Baghdad discussions very soon. So, you know, just to conclude, in summary, I don't think that any of this will produce the sort of holy grail of a grand compact, a political agreement in Iraq that the Iraqis take responsibility for, this sort of holy grail that we've all been looking for so long, and I think is now being increasingly identified as the solution for Iraq as people in Washington ponder the question of US troop levels and seek to have the Iraq government step up to the plate to reach the political agreements that they need to reach. I don't see such a political agreement as being in the offing. I wish it were, but it isn't. I don't think that these oil agreements, excellent though they may be, are those. You know, it's not that holy grail, but it's a modest step in the right direction. And as I said, it's not only the substance of the agreements, but the technique by which they were reached that that may point a way towards progress in Iraq.
Thank you, Jonathan.
I'm going to open the floor in a minute to discussion and comment, and there are two microphones set up. I urge people to line up if they would. First, I wanted to ask Jim Plack whether he wanted to add anything, knowing his deep knowledge of this and knowing that he will soon testify. Is there anything, Jim, you would like to add?
I would appreciate, however, if possible, a little bit more of a clarification of the key issue of review of regional contracts. There seems to be, on the one hand, an assertion of absolute authority over the contracts within each region, and on the other, you described a mechanism for arbitration. Well, how do you get there? What's the process?
Jonathan?
Sure. In broad form, the process would be for a proposed, I understand. I have to say I wasn't privy to those negotiations. But the way it's described in the draft and the way I understand the Kurdistan regional government to see it is that a proposed Kurdistan government contract would be agreed, approved by the Kurdistan government. They would accept it, perhaps not sign it, but it would be submitted to the Federal Council on Oil and Gas, its intergovernmental entity, that would then have an opportunity, I think 60 days, to look at that contract. They would then have the opportunity on certain agreed criteria which may in fact be annexed to this hydrocarbons law, I think should be, criteria of commerciality and probity, agreed criteria, they would have the ability to review that. And if the Federal Petroleum Committee concluded that the Kurdistan or proposed Kurdistan contract did not meet one or more of those criteria, they would then have the ability to refer that contract to a independent panel of Iraqi experts, independent having been jointly appointed by the Kurdistan government and the Petroleum Committee. Having been unanimously appointed by the Petroleum Committee, which amounts to the same thing, and it would report back, and if its finding was that in fact the Kurdistan contract fell outside one of those criteria, I'm talking about future contracts, not existing ones. If a contract fell outside one of either of those criteria, then the Kurdistan government would be required to would have the opportunity to amend that draft contract and resubmit it to the Federal Petroleum Committee. So that's the process. It's one that is a concession on the Kurdistan government's part to a reasonable interest that the federal government has in knowing what is going on in the Kurdistan region, and making sure that it is part of a national, that it doesn't fall outside the bounds of the national petroleum policy, which of course the constitution requires be jointly developed. But it also addresses the core Kurdish or Kurdistani anxiety on all this. Is that in the past, of course, Kurdistan petroleum has been deliberately kept in the ground by successive Baghdad governments, and they're not, at a basic level, they're not prepared to surrender the ability to prevent that from happening in the future. And so this is why I think it's sensible. It may not be perfect, but it's a compromise that I think will work. And of course, the parties agreed to it in December.
Yeah,
and I believe we should, agree to it now.
Mr. Shafiq.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to, in response to this important question, to say that my colleague here really takes me back to the argument that the serious argument about the interpretation of the Constitution takes me back to over 6 months ago. I have in front of me, and I wish there would be possibility for a projection, the latest thinking of the Minister of Oil, which was reported to an audience similar to this, including myself, in London on the 8th of December, in which he referred to himself as assuring each and everyone he is not only a Kurd, he is an Iraqi, which is the hopeful thinking for all Iraqi to think, not along sectarian or ethnic lines. And he stated that the three principles which of the Constitution, I wish I could project them, they relinquish their interpretation to these, and their interpretation fall in line to the interpretation held by the Ministry of Oil and the federal government. My colleague here, I don't know, perhaps he's more privy to the present thinking of Kurdistan, which would mean really a reversal of position, or perhaps no consensus among the leaders of Kurdistan on this particular issue. Now, as to how about the Kurdistan present enacted agreement, the message I have from Baghdad, from the minister himself, is that, and I think he would never move out of this position, that these, which in the eye of many have been considered illegal, would have to undergo a review to bring them in line with the criteria of this law. And the law talks about reasonable return on investment and nothing like 55% profit sharing in the PSAs. This is never done, and it could have been accepted in the past because of the unique circumstances of the Kurds being isolated, being in the situation where they are, and their miseries and the criminal act of Saddam Hussein. But that era is gone, and we've got to go back to thinking as Iraqis.
Before I let Jonathan reply again, I wanted to explain to those who may not be privy to all the ins and outs of this subject that the point on which Jim has asked this question and on which the two speakers have responded now is really a vital question, because it's the one thought to be holding up the petroleum law at this point. And with all due respect to Jonathan's view that the petroleum law may not be a magic elixir to resolve political problems, I do think that there's a general view it is a necessary condition, as he said himself, to moving forward. So this is not just a trivial issue of a few oil contracts. It's really what's holding things up. So understanding what is really holding things up becomes much more important than maybe the issue in and of itself might appear to the uninitiated. Jonathan?
Sure. There is unanimity amongst the leadership of the Kurdistan regional government. I'm looking at Dr. Shafiq's computer screen, he referred to the KRG having set aside an interpretation of the constitution. It's a slide which describes the question of, I'm glad he raises this because this is also, I think, important. It raises the question of petroleum ownership. There's an article in the constitution, I think Dr. Shafiq quoted it, oil and gas are the property of all Iraqi people in all regions and governorates. What does that actually mean? Does that actually give to governorates and regions some kind of ownership right of oil as distinct from a national one? This was the subject matter of a lot of discussion and debate. I think very helpfully that discussion has been set aside. The question of ownership, I think, in this case, as in many other cases around the world, is a distraction. Dr. Harami, on the 8th of December, as Dr. Shafiq recalls, did remind his audience on that date that the Kurdistan government, as part of its package of concessions, if you like, is no longer advancing any ownership argument. I don't think that it necessarily will surrender the right to do so in the future, but again, as interests and thinking converges around what I would have described as an sort of intergovernmental administration of Iraq's petroleum sector, this provision is, I think, really no longer relevant. I'm also glad that Dr. Shafiq raised the question of existing Kurdistan region contracts, some of which I agree are on the generous side of what one might see in production sharing agreements. One might expect that to have been the case, given the politics and geopolitics of the Kurdistan region. They're not as generous as they might look since there is significant government participation in all of those contracts. In any event, yes, it is. Dr. Shafiq's information is correct. There is no disagreement on the need for there to be a process by which those contracts, if necessary — I don't think it will be, but if necessary — can be brought into line with the criteria that I mentioned would be laid out in the as a mechanism for reviewing future contracts. So there will be a mechanism for doing that, but of course that will be a Kurdistan review of those contracts. That won't be — will not — those existing contracts will not be submitted to the Federal Petroleum Committee. The Article 141 of the Iraq Constitution explicitly validates those contracts, so it is Kurdistan's prerogative to review those, and it's in its interest to review those in light of the criteria I mentioned that would be annexed to this law. I should also say these criteria are not only there to to check perceived, I think perhaps misperceived, ideas of Kurdish irregularity. They're there also to serve as a check on production sharing agreements, or in fact any other kind of agreement that may be concluded by the Ministry of Oil in Baghdad, or any other entity that may wish to do an oil deal in the future, that the ground rules are established by these criteria, which at least in the future would be for future contracts would be applied to those contracts, and if necessary sent for arbitration. So it's a uniform regime.
Others who have questions, please. Please identify yourself first. Okay.
My name is Rafael. I'm with the Middle East Media Research Institute. I have a couple of questions to Dr. Shafiq. First, how do you answer the critics that the war in Iraq was a war for oil? Second, what is the status of the contract signed by the previous regime with the French, Chinese, and Russian companies? And third, is there much difference between the oil in the south and the oil in the north in terms of viscosity, lightness, and so forth? Thank you.
Mr. Shafiq.
You've asked very sensitive questions, but I'll answer them with my usual frankness. The First World War did not start because of desire to control the oil of the Middle East, certainly not, because there was no oil discovered there. But by the end of the war, the victorious party had to see where their interests lie, and oil was one of them. Now, the war that took place and the Allied forces invaded Iraq, got rid of Saddam, which is a great credit to them, started an era of democracy, great credit to them, although this is undergoing some serious problems. I wouldn't be surprised if oil will come up to the surface as an important matter, economic matter, for the Allied and the rest of the world to ensure that a country that has so much reserve, which amounts to over 10%, 15% of the world reserve, they would set their eye on it and want to ensure that the area would remain unturbulent and in harmony with the rest of the world to exploit that oil under the general rules acceptable to the nation and the global community. And that's as far as I could say. Now, as to the oil contracts which you have referred to, I believe they will need to undergo revision, very much like the revision of the Kurdistan agreements. And I'm really surprised that my friend talks about Kurdistan as if it is a separate state. It is not. They say, and we all say, it's part of Iraq. It is part of Iraq. They are Iraqis. I'm talking as Iraqi despite the fact that perhaps one third of me is Kurdish. I'm not 100% Arabic. I'm partly Kurdish, but we all think and we find this turbulence among sectarian and ethnic problem hopefully will be temporary and not a permanent one. And I'm sure the Kurd people think that way. I have relatives among them. I know how they think. I know how we think. My friend begs it as if it is a separate state. I'm surprised it is not. And they don't say it is.
Differences between northern and southern oil?
Sorry?
He asked about differences between oil in the north and the south.
And that's the technical, in what sense?
Technical differences.
Well, I like to look at Iraq as a unit. Its oil is a unit. It's owned by all its people. However, oil in nature is never divided equally into all parts of the world. Distribution is unequal in that sense. One province, which is Kirkuk, for example, contain today over 50% of Iraq proven reserve. And that by itself a simple fact that Iraq needs a unified policy, unified ownership. And that ownership cannot be divided. It is a common ownership. And as such, I don't know if your question relates to how much oil distribution there is in the north. It's the characteristic of the oil.
He was asking about the quality of oil north and south.
Not really, no. Kirkuk produces 36 API gravity. Basra produces 36 API gravity. There are reservoirs in the north, as in the south, that have heavy oil, as heavy as 10 and 15 API, and so there is no... The distribution inequality goes more from the east to the west as you go into the western desert than going from south to north.
Please.
Yes, I'm Bernie Carreau from the National Defense University. I was wondering if both speakers could address the relationship between the draft laws, not just the petroleum law, but potential revenue-sharing laws and the hydrocarbon laws, with the Federalist principles in the Constitution. It's my understanding, and I used to be more familiar with the articles in the Constitution last year, I can't remember which is which, but it is my understanding that the Federalist principles in the Constitution is what is causing a lot of the concern. The Federalist principle kind of turns the principle on its head in that in most federal systems, such as the U.S. or Canada, when there's a conflict between regional law, state law, and federal law always trumps the regional law. In Iraq, that principle is turned on its head in the Constitution in that the regional laws can trump the federal law. And that's a huge problem. So from the Sunni's perspective, no matter what national law comes out, it seems to me, there is always the possibility that if the regions, the Kurdish regions or the Shia regions in the south don't like what Baghdad does, they will always have the opportunity to trump it with their own regional laws. And I wonder if you could address that issue and what is being done or could be done about it.
Jonathan.
Thanks. Yes, it's a important provision of the Constitution. I think it's the central one, actually. It's a provision in the Constitution, Article 115, without which the Constitution, I think, would not have been agreed. Regional law does trump federal law, of course, outside any of the areas of exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government, which, of course, include foreign affairs and defense and some other standard federal powers. I don't characterize that provision as a problem. In fact, I referred earlier to the Constitution of Iraq as being a fairly accurate map of political realities, very imperfect though that constitution is. Very imperfectly though was the process by which that constitution was produced. Nonetheless, as a document reflecting political realities, abiding political realities in Iraq, I think it serves its purpose, and that provision serves its purpose. And in particular, since we're talking about Baghdad and Erbil, had that provision not appeared, let's imagine a constitution that did not have that provision and, let's say, asserted federal law over regional law to the extent of any inconsistency, that would not be implemented. The political reality in Erbil is that it would not submit to assertions of federal control. It is an entity that has a parliament and legislation. If by some machination that provision were to be removed, I doubt very much whether to be perfectly frank with you, I doubt very much whether the practice in Erbil would change dramatically. And certainly on questions of oil, the Kurds are well aware that in most federal nations that oil producers, including my own, its regions have a large degree of say in the management of petroleum in their region. Just to respond to Dr. Shafiq, you know, Kurdistan is not a separate state. That's correct, it's not, and it's true that people of Kurdistan don't see themselves as an independent state. That's not to say, of course, they don't have, many of them don't have ambitions in that direction. I would argue is that if progress is to be made, and progress is being made, then it doesn't work to say, oh yes, everyone in Iraq is an Iraqi, should be an Iraqi, should think like an Iraqi, and we should come up with a law that reflects that reality. It's not a reality. It is not true. Most Kurds do not think of themselves as Iraqi. They think of themselves as citizens of the Kurdistan region. I don't make a value judgment about that, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a fact. And if you want to bring about, as I think we all do, bring about cooperation, consensus, sharing of resources, intelligent cooperation, respecting the differences that exist within Iraq, then you actually have to acknowledge those differences, work from the outside in, if you like, build in, as this draft hydrocarbons law does, rather than starting at the centre, as people have so often, and watching things fall apart. The pressures in Iraq are centrifugal, not centripetal. We have to acknowledge that and build in, not imagine a unitary, unified state with homogenous Iraqi identity. Because though that may have been a good thing for Iraq, it may be that is something we might all want to be the case. But it just whether we like it or not, it just isn't.
Mr. Shafiq.
Yes, sir. Now. Again, the charts in the front of me, which are a statement, written a statement announced by Dr. Ashdi, dropped that interpretation where the regional laws take over. The interpretation I have, which is done by an independent and, I'd say, American firm, says that particular article relates, which it comes after 114 content is everything, many things other than oil, and the reference here is about matters that deal in Article 114, and it's not related to oil. And if it does, it would have to be one of these major issues that need to be rectified, because I don't know if my friend to my left is very aware of how we Iraqis live. Now, the provinces really, particularly having lived the era of Saddam, unequal distribution of wealth, but equal criminal acts to all Iraqis, and not just the Kurds or the southern people, is that they are not even capable of cleansing the streets today. They have no institutions whatsoever. Now, how could you then suddenly and abruptly give them a whole authority to rule and legislate in such a force that overtakes the strength of the rule of the central government? After all, we are not living in a Saddam era. There is a council of representatives, the parliaments, who is elected by all the people of Iraq, who entrust a particular government, that's the federal government, which represent not only the province of Kurdistan or the province of Basra or Baghdad, it represent all Iraqis. And it is there that the power ought to lie, and in any democratic society, the power lies in the representative of those people, and it is their rule that the federal laws should naturally supersede, and you cannot leave it, at least at this stage and for a good many years before there would be constitutions in these provinces that are at the infancy of their training to rule themselves, to give them that power to legislate over the authority of the federal laws. Are really sheer dreams and political naivety.
I note that there's a sharp difference on this issue. I also note that in American history, this issue led to very sharp differences, and that the initial decades of the Republic were largely devoted to resolving these issues. Please.
Hi, my name is Heike Meinhardt-Gibbs. I'm with the Bank Information Center, and I have three quick questions. The first one is actually one of clarification. Dr. Shavik, you briefly mentioned with regards to the contracts that there will be public disclosure, and forgive me, I didn't quite catch exactly what was required of them, and if you could just state what the draft law requires of public disclosure of the contracts. Are they the full contracts? Are they just certain terms? Please just give me clarification on that. And what is specific to the law? Secondly, I am wondering and have great appreciation for the need to accelerate the development of the oil sector. But I also wonder how much attention is being paid to the issue of the possible concerns and problems with having it be accelerated at a certain pace during a time of conflict, during a time of turmoil in the country, given the history of this happening in other countries such as Russia, Kazakhstan, Bolivia, and some of the issues and problems that have happened after such an approach was taken to sign a lot of very lucrative, important contracts during that time. And because I'm saying this also because I'm wondering on the specific timeline, it will take time to get the companies to come in and feel comfortable to actually develop, as was mentioned, given the security concerns. But a lot of the contracts, the PSAs, will be signed. And the IMF has alluded to even a time frame of saying a lot of them being signed by 2008. And so that also brings me to my last and third question. How much involvement has the IMF and World Bank had, given the IMF benchmark for the draft law was December, and that's part of the reason why it happened quickly, given it has a $600 million program in the country? And how much involvement then did the World Bank have in the draft law, given they've written advisory papers on the sector and are advising the IMF and have stated that they're at these meetings? I'm just wondering, what do the IFIs, what are their connection to it? Thank
Mr. Shafiq?
I'm not sure really if I caught all the questions there, but let me start with the very last, the IMF role, for example. I can tell you with all frankness, I myself have only one video conferencing with the IMF asking them about their views on the transparency and tendering procedure. Absolutely no discussion even with the IMF on the petroleum law. As credible as they are, but keeping the sensitivity we know of Iraqis about the demonstration that they want to think independently and act independently, I even refrain to discuss issues pertinent to the petroleum law other than transparency, which we had advice from. And in fact, on this visit of mine, I visited them only yesterday, hoping they would give us some idea on a watertight tendering process that does not leave too much for playing about.
If I can just add
Go ahead. Now, on the issue of, if I understand the question on the issue of relevance to satellites of Russia, and the so many contracts they signed, I'm talking here about a draft law. Draft law does not talk about plans and strategic policy. The next steps will be plans and strategic policy. I'm one of those who would perhaps have your same fear that Iraq should not overnight go to sign too many oil agreements. If it does, very quickly, I hope that would concentrate on the growth of production and not exploration, simply because Iraq's 115 billion barrels can support a production rate as high as 10 million barrels per day. Iraq would need another decade or two to reach that level, and hence to rush now for exploration contracts, it might not be the wisest thing to do. And I hope that the oil companies would also realize this, and I'm sure they do. And as such, my advice to the government, and I'm independent, I'm not an employee of the government, and publicly I have declared this. There are many people who think Iraq's today lack of sovereignty in a way, realistically, and the public opinion may not be in favor of dashing too many exploration contracts.
What about the transparency provisions? Would the whole contracts be made available or parts of them?
The transparency, in fact, I also share your fear, and I have only recently from here sent a letter to Baghdad in my capacity as an Iraqi individual to say, for God's sake, why don't you publish the draft contract? And I think there was a very reasonable response. I think recently they have shown it at least to some journalists to read it and make comments. The next step, I think, would be in a few days when they will declare that there is an agreement in hand. They will, I assume, publish the final agreement. Maybe the thinking is that this is, after all, it's only a draft. No point of raising doubts and arguments while it is a draft among the family itself, among the Kurds, among the Arabs, among the different parties. And maybe, possibly, that was the reason for the delay. The transparency is such as is written from a model, really, that we have external help with, because we, at least I'm not expert on that line, neither my colleagues, is, I think, reasonably tight to ensure that there will be contracts to be published, and the thinking of the think tank that support the Council of Ministers in negotiation and reviewing policy and strategy ought to be also published, and things along that line.
Please.
Hello, Steve Lord, GAO. I had two questions, actually. I think they're easier than the ones you were just posed. But the first question is very basic. Where is the draft hydrocarbon law in the Iraqi legislative process? I understand it may have to undergo three readings in Parliament. Could you just comment, number one, on how many readings, if any, have been completed? Second question is the royalty payments provided to foreign firms. It's my understanding the current legislation allows for payments of 12.5%, yet Dr. Sadiq, I believe you commented earlier, the current legislation does not include any such numbers. So if you could just clarify that. And also, if you have any information on how this relates to royalty payments provided in to foreign firms in neighboring states, I think that would be very interesting as well. Thanks.
Mr. Shafiq.
I'm not really very knowledgeable on the procedure. My friend here, I'm sure he is more knowledgeable on that. But my understanding is that within the next few days, the Council of Ministers would have to study the negotiated draft and hopefully approve it, and then it goes to the Parliament to take as a procedure. I understand that could take up to about 3 months to be finalized. Now, I'm very sorry that when I said there are no numbers mentioned, I'm talking about the contracts, not about all the issues. On royalty, yes, there is a royalty of 12.5%. There will be, I assume, revision to include income tax. I'm personally of the opinion that you need to make contracts as easy as possible. And in fact, I personally would not mind even if there was no income tax there, because after all, when you negotiate a contract, you want to, by the end of the day, see how much each party would take in terms of profit and income and the other party, and how much control there is for each party to be able to function properly and fairly. And so on that issue, I'm sorry if I confused you on the numbers.
Jonathan, I owe you an extra minute or two also from the last question.
Yeah, I mean, just on the procedure, then that's quite right. It has not been read at all in Iraq Parliament. It's not been submitted to Parliament, not yet been submitted to Cabinet, to the Council of Ministers. It's a negotiated text, or a text perhaps still even in negotiation. Just going back a little bit to some previous questions, it's my experience also from the Kurdistan side that the involvement of the IMF and the World Bank has been minimal. I think that may be to some extent explicable by invitations not having been issued to them to weigh in on some of the drafts. I know the officials well who have been nonetheless following the matter closely. The Kurdistan government's been encouraging as much bank and fund involvement as possible, and I think in particular, I mean, speaking for myself, I'd personally very much like to see bank and fund involvement in the revenue sharing law, which is of course very important. To respond to a still earlier question, and without wanting to engage in polemics, going back to this provision in the Constitution that gives regional law priority over federal law to the extent of inconsistency, I am aware that the Kurdistan government is, of course, setting aside that prerogative, if you like, for the purpose of this, for the purpose of an Iraq oil law. So, for instance, you know, where it agrees that Kurdistan future contracts might be submitted for arbitration in Baghdad, well, it's not going to pass legislation in Erbil, is what they're saying, to contradict that and supersede that. They will adhere to that agreement. What they're not saying, of course, and I think Dr. Shafiq implies this, is not correct. They're not saying that somehow the Kurdistan regional government relinquishes all rights that it has under the Constitution forever and ever to ever
I never implied that.
For these purposes, yes, that's not an issue. There's perhaps a much greater level of agreement on these matters than this discussion may have conveyed.
Please.
Good morning. My name is Judy Mathewson. I'm a reporter with Bloomberg News. And if I could clarify one thing, it would help me know whether maybe you've just answered my question. Is the Iraqi oil law synonymous with the hydrocarbon law? Are we talking about that? Okay, that's all one thing. Mm-hmm. Then perhaps you've answered my question, Dr. Shafiq. I just wanted to make sure I understood correctly that you had said all the differences have been settled, in fact, and the draft is at hand. And I wondered among whom has it been settled, because it doesn't seem, forgive me, but based on what I'm hearing today, it doesn't sound like everything has been settled between the
very
Kurdish.
Fair
Maybe
question,
both of you could
yes.
take a crack at that. And again, I want to make sure I understand how soon this might come before Parliament. I'd be most grateful.
Mr. Shafiq.
I must tell you that when we drafted, I and my colleagues, the petroleum law, we drafted it for Iraq. We did not draft it for the federal government. We did not draft it for Kurdistan or any other province. And hence, we created a scheme where there will be more than just consultation for the provinces. There is sharing in every step of the decision-making. And there is no time here to go elaborate how that sharing works. Example of that, the holding company will have operating companies in each and every region. That operating company would be the decision-making for it could be shared by the region up to the up to a proportionate rate of 50% of the shares. The supervision would be handed over completely, not done in consultation with the region, but to the regions. And there is a lot of this. The commission created will have Iraqis from all the regions, and specifically they must have representatives from the region. There is a lot of really common and participation in the decision making. So when we drafted that petroleum law, we drafted for Iraq as the in order to ensure optimum exploitation, optimum management of the resource. We wished to isolate the issue of revenue because petroleum law has nothing to do with distribution of revenue, and we didn't look at that at all. However, and the time when we started over this, contrary to what was said a while ago, was much before when the Kurdistan regime issued their draft. We were not aware of it. In fact, the Minister of Kurdistan Oil, the Minister of Oil for Kurdistan, I was told was going to be a member of the drafting team, a member with us to work on this, plus a representative from the Ministry of Oil. However, neither showed up. I never asked the question as to why, really. And then suddenly, in fact, we saw a draft of the Kurdish petroleum law. And in fact, with my usual frankness, I tell you, I wrote to the minister, I said something to the effect, we may have to stop writing anything, because if we want to amalgamate the terms and conditions in the Kurdistan draft, we cannot do that. It's impossible.
So
told by the minister, don't go ahead and write something for Iraq. So what I meant is that the draft did not leave room for concessions between different parties. However, I, like you, faced with seeing that the draft there was under, scratch my back, I scratch your back, between perhaps the representative of Kurdistan and the rest of the country. This is really what has happened. But gladly, things turn out to be with amicable solutions and not radical change in the draft.
And who has now agreed?
Yeah, who has
agreed?
According to the message I had and the latest draft, which I have not had time to read, there is an agreement, a final draft in hand that is finished and endorsed.
But it's finished and endorsed between whom?
There is a negotiating committee.
Yeah.
The negotiating committee is made perhaps of some 7 or 9 senior Iraqi personalities, include members from Kurdistan, like members from the other section of the governing council.
So agreed.
So among those, there is a final agreement. We have no differences over this. There may be that sticking point, perhaps the wording for that sticking point over.
If I may.
That is all I know. Other than this, I don't.
Janet.
Right. For the draft to be agreed, it will need Kurdistan Regional Government agreement. The Kurdistan Regional Government has a representative on the relevant body. It's called the Iraq Petroleum Committee. That's the way it's conventionally described in English. It's a body that Deputy Prime Minister Barham Saleh presides over. It has the Kurdistan Oil Minister as one of its members, as is the Iraq Oil Minister and others, other officials. I'm yet to see Kurdistan Regional Government confirmation of their agreement to the draft that Dr. Shafiq describes as being in hand. I'm not saying that that is not imminent. I do, however, go out on a limb and make a prediction that that if that draft in hand, as he describes it, asserts Baghdad's a right of approval of past and future Kurdistan oil contracts, then the Kurdistan government will likely not agree to it, that that agreement will not be forthcoming. That's my own personal prediction. I very much look forward, of course, as does everyone, to final agreement. I believe, as I've, I think, described, there is a very sensible compromise outcome on that, some of those difficult issues, a compromise outcome that was actually agreed to, at least in principle, in December last year. So, as with everyone else, I'm now looking to the KRG for its reaction to the draft. I've seen a draft up till a couple of days ago. I've had it confirmed that the KRG, as of yesterday, did not agree to a draft. You know, the issue of approvals was still in the air, and the KRG's position was as I've described, and I have no reason for thinking that's changed. And as I say, I very much hope that the sensible compromise is reached.
Thank you.
Please.
I'm Hossein Ibn Youssef with International Petroleum Enterprises. Iraq has been a member of OPEC, a very important member, and yet there's been very little discussion on Iraq's obligations to OPEC, and there's been very little or none discussed today, really, to relate the two. The reality is that Iraq is almost a landlocked country, with the exception of the little opening on the top of the northern tip of the Persian Gulf. Iraq is really dependent on its neighboring countries, Turkey, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and so on, for the future export of oil to a great deal. So the question, seems to me, has to be what kind of opening and how much is reasonable. On the reserves issue, even the official reserve figures of 115 or so on should really be taken with a grain of salt, maybe a large one. And yet, Dr. Shafiq, added quite a bit to those reserve figures, and yet you mentioned that Kirkuk itself would have 50% of the total reserves of the country.
Sorry, I said the province of Basra has 50%, not
Kirkuk. Oh, the Basra.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. On the finding cost of half a cent, that has certainly been the lowest figure I've ever heard.
You don't read my publications, do you?
Well, if it's if they find a 1 billion barrel field, you're assuming that the total cost would be only $5 million. That seems awfully low. But the model contracts that you mentioned, the service contracts and buybacks, are essentially the same. Buyback is a service contract. And then the modified PS production sharing agreement, I don't know what you mean by modified PSA. There are over 2,000 PSAs in the world, and and you can't find two that are exactly the same. So if it's modified, it's basically back to some type of service contract. So essentially, we're limited to service contract that has been rejected by at least major oil companies throughout the world.
Let me step you there. You've asked a lot of questions already, and I want to give Mr. Shafiq a chance to reply.
Well, you're right. Buyback contract is essentially a service contract, but for ascertaining the identification, we use buyback as if it is a different from service contract. Service contract have a spectrum of many other forms, but specifically you mentioned buyback as being a separate one. Now, PSA, modified PSA, I talk, during the experience of some 10 years during Saddam regime, they moved from one position to the next, depending on who was the oil minister and what was the theme of the power pockets existed then. And they moved from a service contract for just simply fees per barrel produced to a buyback contract and then to PSA. And then they worked out something they called a modified one, which is a production development contract, they called it. which is really a mixture between the YBAC and the traditional PSAs. PSAs have general outlines which you and I would agree on, and regardless of the figures in it. But it is principally a PSA modified with touches of YBAC. I'm not privy yet to the that modified one. In fact, it is being worked out now as a model contract, and it will be subject to further studies before it will be part of the law.
Jonathan.
Just very briefly on that, I mean, to be frank with you, I mean, this was a point of some tension between the Kurdistan regional government and some of the negotiators in Baghdad. The Kurdistan government and the oil minister in particular has no love of buybacks. In fact, the draft Kurdistan law prohibits the use of buyback contracts. It's a production sharing model will be the standard for development in the Kurdistan region.
Please.
Hi, Doug Norlin with a nonprofit organization called Pacific Environment. And we know that in other countries and other contexts, production sharing agreements and other foreign investment contracts, a central feature of them is stabilization clauses. There's been an increasing concern among environmental, human rights, social, other public interest groups that stabilization clauses can override domestic environmental and social and human rights laws and protections, can freeze them or discourage the progressive evolution of them. And that can sometimes cause conflict at the local level, which can escalate sometimes to a national level, which can be worsened by the fact that disputes over such things are not decided in local courts if arbitration clauses bring it to an international tribunal. Given that an underlying question here today was whether or not the draft law and future contracts may result in a decrease in, or may help to decrease sectarian and other kinds of violence, can you say anything about, in the draft law or in the model contract that you spoke of, what kinds of, what is the nature of stabilization clauses? What, how broad and sweeping are they? If they are there.
Let me take our last questioner at the same time, and then we'll give the panel a chance to respond.
Yeah, hi, Paul Davis, BA. My basic question is that we talk a lot about what happens with the law. The law's going to have this. The law's going to have this in it. In fact, the Council of Representatives in Baghdad has basically failed to pass any law. It has not even been able to reach quorum. What happens with the Kurdish oil while all of this is being debated? We may be talking years before this law actually takes effect. What is the effect on the Kurdish, like Duhok, all the exploration and drilling in Duhok?
Jonathan, let me start with Jonathan and then give Mr. Shafiq a last word.
Yeah, sure. I mean, when we were talking about procedure earlier, I should have mentioned, I also have observed that the Council of Representatives has failed to reach quorum, I think, for maybe 30 days in a row, something like that. Yeah. It hasn't been able to pass its own budget. It's got a raft of, urgent legislation ahead of it, and it's not clear, given the security environment in Baghdad, when that quorum will be reached. So, Dr. Shafiq mentioned maybe 2 or 3 months. I mean, who knows when the law could be addressed. What happens to Kurdistan oil in the absence of a Baghdad law? Well, I mean, the Kurdistan regional government has really answered that question 6 months ago when it published a draft petroleum law for the Kurdistan region for public comment, when it invited oil companies to negotiate under the principles of that Kurdistan law. Their public statement was that they have the right to do so, to move ahead, notwithstanding inactivity in Baghdad because of the constitution. And that's an argument which I have to say has not been contradicted by anyone that I'm aware of who has studied the Iraq constitution. It's not particularly controversial. Exploration will continue. Development is some way out, of course. As I've mentioned, in the absence of a Baghdad law. I mean, the Kurdistan regional government's sensible offers of compromise, and in particular revenue sharing and so on, still stand, and I think the Kurds will remain ready to reach agreement on these matters and support Baghdad legislation whenever that embodies those cooperative principles, whenever it may emerge from the system in Baghdad. But I have to say, you know, again, speaking very frankly and for myself, there is a little, more than a little, scepticism in Erbil now as to whether some of these laws and institutions will really, you know, take effect, or indeed whether they'll, in particular, whether they'll come into existence anytime soon. So they are, I think, being responsible, behaving responsibly within Iraq and trying to accelerate these discussions as much as possible, but I don't think at the same time they're holding their breath.
Mr. Shafiq?
The official stand as declared by the Minister of Oil on the Kurdistan PSAs is that they are not recognized, they are unacceptable. I don't know if he used the term illegal, I'm not sure of that, but unacceptable, definitely that's the case. Now, what will happen to these in the interim period? I don't think that worries the Kurdistan government. They have enacted this agreement without the approval of the central government. And if we recognize that the oil and gas is the property of the whole nation, the only party that can represent the whole nation is the Parliament for Iraq, and that parliament has not approved that agreement yet. And so this is how I understand the situation. And so far as the stabilization clause, part of me was a leftist, Marxist when I was young, and I sympathize with many of the things you're talking about. But to be realistic, international oil companies that would come and invest $10 billion in Iraq, and to tell them that, hey, fellows, in 5 years' time we'll have to review the contract, under the present circumstances of Iraq, with all this chaos and unstable government and unstable position. Can you really do that? I ask you. It's impossible. So really, the contracts will be for a solid period of time. However, that is stated in the law, will not exceed 20 years, and not 40 or 60, as been speculated. And this dogma of how long a contract is, oil in reservoirs such as in Iraq can be of a volume of 10 billion barrels or half a billion barrels. To set a rule that the investor must be an authority to export, to exploit his oil in 20 years, in a fixed period of time, 20 or 30 or 40, depends really very much on the size of these reserves and how easily they can be brought to the surface. They also have a very pertinent, important factor, is that in the earlier years are relatively inexpensive because of the natural flow of the oil, and it comes up by itself to the surface and has your secondary recoveries and secondary exploitation and production schemes are not needed. As you get to producing about half of that oil, then you start the decline, and then your investment is much higher, much more difficult. And now, and hence, if you set a definite short period or long period, if it is too short a period, then the investor may be very happy that he would exploit the cheap oil and leave the state with the more expensive oil. And hence you have to always strike a balance between the length of the contract to make sure it is commensurate with the nature of the reservoirs to be exploited. And I wish Iraq could be in that position. I have always wanted to have a review, but I don't think that's practical under today's circumstances for Iraq.
Let me just say in closing that I'm very struck by areas of agreement and disagreement in this conversation. It's clear that Iraq has lots of oil potential, that the law is very close, that doesn't mean it's immediate. It could take a long time still, that revenue sharing is a separate issue, and I think that's an important thing to acknowledge, and that, frankly, neither revenue sharing nor the petroleum law may make all that much difference. After all, this is not a subject on which the Sunni insurgents or even Sunni political representatives have cared much to engage. Big differences on federalism, but I urge you all to remember that there were big differences on federalism in this country, in Canada, I suppose Australia, though I don't know its history, and we have to be patient, it seems to me, because those won't be worked out overnight. That's going to take decades to do. But I think we should thank our panel, which has been most enlightening, and join me in recognizing them.